Welcome, guys. This is Mick Donaghy on another episode of The Recruitment Show. This is episode 13. Today on the podcast, we have a very special guest. His name is Rob Campbell. Rob is one of New Zealand's most prominent directors and board members. Rob sits on the board of some of New Zealand's most high-profile businesses, such as Sky City, Somerset Precinct Properties, and a number of others. He is very outspoken on LinkedIn and has over 20,000 people who follow him on that platform. He's got an amazing reputation within the industry and has went from owning an anarchist bookshop in the 60s and 70s through to sitting in some of the most high profile positions in New Zealand. So it's an absolute pleasure to have on to the show today, Rob Campbell. We're live, so thank you, Rob, for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Just going to obviously sort of get into the cut to the chase just a little bit. It's obviously great having you here, and it's great to have someone with such a high profile within New Zealand and taking part in the show, so I really do appreciate it. One thing I just wanted to ask is, I've been in New Zealand for the last 3 years. I'm an Irish immigrant. The types of opportunities that have been presented to me in New Zealand have far outweighed those I've been presented to in Ireland and the United Kingdom. What do you think it is that makes New Zealand so great in terms of being able to do business?
Well, I think there are plenty of things that colonisation did badly for New Zealand.
Yeah.
But from a business point of view, one of the things that it did well was to introduce a rule of law, which is one which is conducive to doing business, mm-hmm. and conducive to having a reasonable life too. So there are mm-hmm. good freedoms and recognitions of freedoms mm-hmm. For people to express themselves and be themselves. I think we've evolved to a society which has a lot of good about in that respect. You have to, if you sense some hesitation in my voice, there are some, there has been a resurgent Maori nationalism in New Zealand in recent years. But all the statistics about Maori participation in our economy and in our society are really poor. Mm-hmm. The outcomes are certainly poor. And while they are being addressed, I think we have to realise that it's quite recent. In my lifetime, there was an enormous amount of racism towards Maori. Mm-hmm. I can recall it. I can't even promise I never participated in it, mm-hmm. I guess, because I don't remember feeling that way, but it certainly was a much bigger part of society when I was growing up than would be acceptable now. So that's still there. I think, secondly, we love the Pacific Islanders in two contexts. One is when they're playing for our All Blacks.
Yeah.
The other is when they do the work that other New Zealanders don't necessarily want to do. So mm-hmm. we have a quite shameful history of exploiting labour from the Pacific Islands, from Tonga, Samoa, Fiji, other places, bringing them in when it suits and marginalising them when it doesn't, either trying to send them home or, more recently, really leaving those people ghettoised in jobs at the lower skilled, lower paid end. Mm-hmm. So there is a veneer, of colonialism still in the New Zealand character and in the way we run our society, which isn't fully addressed.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, and relative to most of the world, I think opportunities do exist, are created, and we need to foster them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And do you think that there is potentially preferences shown to maybe overseas immigrants, maybe say like myself, or there's quite a big demographic of South Africans and Europeans in New Zealand? Do you think they get a preference over maybe the sort of the Maori people or the Pacifica people?
I do think there is. Again, unfortunate to say so, but I think there is a preference in many types of jobs to employ people of a who look more like the dominant Pākehā culture in New Zealand. Again, I think that is changing. I think generationally it's changing, and in many businesses it's changed. But as a generalisation, I think it still is the case that a person who is a new immigrant, who is a European new immigrant, is likely to find it much easier to get a job than someone from Pakistan, India, Samoa, or indeed Northland in New Zealand.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's maybe something that I've recently had exposure to with my sort of Auckland Got Talent event, which was essentially trying to showcase the great talent that's available within New Zealand. And I believe we had something like 100 people there from 20 different countries all over the world. And you see, you walk down Queen Street in Auckland, and it's New Zealand's probably one of the most cosmopolitan places in the world.
Yeah, certainly Auckland's as multicultural, I think, as any city in the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we look at some of the newer generation of entrepreneurs coming through, and we see the likes of Peter Beck of Rocket Labs. Is there something that you think is in the culture or in the DNA of New Zealand that sort of promotes entrepreneurship?
You know, we like to say so. It's one of the myths New Zealanders like, yeah, that we're good at entrepreneurship. I travel a fair bit. It's one of the luxuries and real pleasures of my job to travel and see a lot of businesses around the world. And I think that it's a myth that New Zealand has some uniquely entrepreneurial character. Mm-hmm. We do have good entrepreneurs in New Zealand. We have a very good education system. We have opportunities for entrepreneurs, but so do countless other cities around the world. And I mm-hmm. think actually some humility, as well as some recognition of real strengths, is quite important to us here. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that holds back New Zealand entrepreneurship in the sense of startup businesses is that often startups overrate themselves in New Zealand too early,
yep,
that they won't accept assistance and won't accept investment at realistic levels.
Mm-hmm.
For every Peter Beck, there's a lot that don't succeed.
Absolutely. And I suppose that's across the globe.
It's the nature of it. The nature of entrepreneurship the common outcome of entrepreneurship is failure. Success is the less common outcome.
Yeah, that's unique.
I think I would say what I often do say to young New Zealanders who are thinking about entrepreneurship or claiming that New Zealand has some reasonably unique characteristics in this respect, I just don't think it's true. You're underestimating how many people there are, not only with the skills, but with the drive and the ambition, and coming from less protected places around the world who you're competing with when you're thinking about your scheme. And just be aware of that and be a little bit humble about it.
Absolutely. And I suppose I'm sensing from what you're saying is that you feel like there's some work to be done. What sort of work do you think should be done to promote even better entrepreneurship? And
I'm a really great believer that the creation of really strong sports teams, if I can divert for a minute, is partly about what you do in your elite systems, but it's no good having an elite system that doesn't have a broad base of participation. And the thing, I think it's true in business too. So I think, to me, the most important thing is to have our educational system providing the opportunities on a much more broad basis than perhaps we've done in the past. For example, we have tended in our society to cut off half of the population, being the female side,
mm-hmm.
From a lot of the science and technology and other industries that you might commonly associate with entrepreneurship these days. We've tended, for whatever reasons, to not encourage Maori and Pacific Island people into those roles as well. I think the growing Asian population, particularly in Auckland, probably pushes its way into those roles, and good on them, from a strong cultural base within their own communities. But for New Zealand, what we have to do is to recognise this diversity that we have culturally as a strength, and to improve the access of people other than those that come from the middle class themselves, other than those that come from a European background, other than those who are male, to see the same opportunities. So I think it's a twofold thing. One is what we in business look for, which is often that we look for people who are like us.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, we have to create the opportunities so that more and more people who are female or who are brown or who are migrants see that they have the potential to grow into these roles. We've got to work at both ends.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, because obviously I said at the outset that I've been presented quite a bit of opportunity in New Zealand. Do you feel that maybe I wouldn't have been presented the same level of opportunity if I had been female or, you know, a different demographic?
Yes, I do, unfortunately. Not universally, obviously one's dealing in generalities here, but as a generalisation, mm-hmm. You look more, when you walk into a room, you will look more like the person interviewing for a job, mm-hmm. doing the interviewing.
Mm.
You will look more like them, despite a bit of an accent issue. Yeah. You will look more like them than the sort of people you're describing. So there's a problem to get over.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I read recently in one of the interviews that you've done recently that 18% of publicly listed companies' directors were female.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that it's quite easy to get rid of that and improve that. How do you go around about improving that?
Well, you just have to persuade some of the current directors that another 10 years in the position isn't the right thing.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing you have to do, get greater turnover happening.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, I'm often say it and I get some negative reactions, but we have to just stop being sexist. If you open your eyes, I mean, gender is the easiest thing. We treat gender issues around directorships, mm-hmm. as if female women were a minority.
Yeah.
It's amazing, you know, why are we even having this discussion? How does it even arise?
Yeah.
You just have, I mean, there are so many well-qualified women for directorship positions that the idea that you can't find them,
mm-hmm.
is simply a matter of your own blindness.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply not true. You know, I spoke at a meeting which is held annually in Auckland, which is, I think, called the Being Bold Conference.
Mm-hmm.
But at the conference they had just before Christmas last year, there were about 700 women in the room,
mm-hmm.
Mainly reasonably young, well-educated, ambitious, looking for director and senior business roles.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was just a very impressive room full of people. And to sit there and say, you know, in fact, I think I opened up by saying, wow, how come people tell me there are not any women available for these jobs in New Zealand?
Yeah.
Just look around the table you're on. So, you know, people say that's an unconscious bias on the part of male directors. And I don't accept that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's purely conscious. The only way in which this is unconscious is if you are genuinely unconscious. In other words,
you've been knocked out.
You're not awake.
If
you're awake and you are still saying we can't find skilled, competent-driven women for these positions, it's a deliberate thing.
Yeah. What I noticed when I put on the event last year showcasing the talent within Auckland, that a lot of the people who inquired about the roles, to be honest, the majority were female. And at one point, I was interviewing so many females that I wasn't too sure whether any males were going to have any interest. But that there were probably two reasons for that. The females who wanted to get into the industry wanted to prove that females can do the work that meals were doing within construction. And I also felt that there was a point to prove, but also probably more were looking for work as well, you know, so there was probably two sides to that coin.
Yeah, I think that, you know, as migrants do, as minorities do, so women do in many roles, have to be a bit more pushy to get through those doors.
Mm.
And, you know, in construction, and I've had a fair bit to do with construction over the years, still involved with it in two of my businesses, it is not that long ago, it's certainly not a decade ago, that the smoko rooms on construction sites had topless women calendars on the walls.
Yep.
They don't now, I don't think, in any construction site I've been onto recently, and it's one of the things that's changed. But that's a very minor thing at one level.
Yep.
At another level, it's highly significant. These were not female-friendly workplaces.
Yep.
And I think, you know, if I think of the big construction sites in Auckland now, which I'm associated with, and there are women working in increasing numbers on those construction sites, they still are quite male places.
Absolutely.
So it takes a bit of guts, I think, to say I'm going to push my way in there and I'm going to prove that I'm really good at this because it's what I want to do.
100%. And all respect to anyone looking to push their way into the industry, and especially those who are maybe a little bit marginalised and don't get overlooked for those sort of positions. Just something else I wanted to sort of talk on, Rob. Obviously, you've got a well-documented journey from owning a bookshop back in the 70s and 80s through to now being on the board of six-something New Zealand corporates. For the youth of today, what advice would you give them in settling on a career path, and does a career path really exist?
Look, I think it probably does. A career path exist? I think it probably still does for some professions. I wouldn't bet on an accounting or a legal profession lasting from, say, 20 through to retirement at, say, 70 mm-hmm. in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a good 50-year bet, personally.
Yep.
So while it's still true today, I don't think it's necessarily going to stay true. You know, my career has really only been a career in the sense that something careers downhill. It's uncontrolled and unplanned.
Yeah.
So I've had a lot of luck in getting to positions offered to me that you know, others I recognise haven't done and probably wouldn't. What I encourage young people to do is to be ambitious about what they want to be as a person. Be ambitious about that, but not be ambitious about particular positions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I think important still that, you know, people want to excel, want to be the best they can be, should seek education and seek job opportunities that enable them to keep on improving their skills and improving, hopefully, the satisfaction they get from their jobs, personal satisfaction they get from their jobs. But be really agnostic about where or how that happens.
Mm-hmm.
The danger for people these days is that they too narrowly slot themselves into, I'm such and such, I'm an electrician, or I'm this or that.
Yeah.
I think that's the dangerous thing.
Mm. Yeah, you can be defined by your career.
Well, you get defined by others and you define yourself as well. We all do that, you know. I've had several goes to define myself. I tried to define myself as an academic, and then I tried to define myself as a trade union official.
Yeah.
Obviously, neither of those were too successful. So, you know, I've had several goes, but we don't all get those goes. I think the other thing in these discussions that it's really important to remember is for most people, you know, we talk a lot today about what the future of work's going to be. The truth is, for most people, the future of work's going to be just what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
A job that's not particularly fulfilling, mm-hmm. a job that's often physically hard,
yeah.
A job that people don't otherwise want to do.
Yeah.
A job which is often unpleasant and a job which is often relatively low paid.
Mm.
And for all the discussions about how work's going to change, the truth is, for most people, it probably won't, unfortunately, change that much.
Mm. And obviously work has changed quite a bit over the last 50 years anyway, so...
Yeah, but there's still people cleaning, toilets, there's still people wiping asses, there's yeah. still people doing all the jobs that
yeah.
Need to be done, and, you know, I don't think they're going to be eliminated all that quickly. One of the fascinating things, I think, about why this debate about what work's going to be like mm-hmm. now,
mm-hmm.
The reason it's happening is that the war's coming home.
Mm.
The change in jobs now is happening to middle-class jobs.
Yeah.
it's happening to the children of the accountants and the journalists and the lawyers
yep.
and the business people.
Pitchforks are out.
They're facing change now. In fact, I think, you know, if you go and spend any time in South Auckland, the jobs that people are doing there aren't that different to what they were doing 20 years ago.
Mm. Mm. You also mentioned about learning and education. In terms of people, say, graduating from university, do you feel like there's a preference over someone with a degree or someone with just a hunger to learn?
It depends where you look, I think. Increasingly, though, the trend is for employers to look for the personal characteristics, yes, some demonstration of skills, but the personal characteristics of a desire to learn, desire to contribute
mm-hmm.
are, I think, more important than the formal qualification going forward.
Mm.
I think they're becoming that way now, and it will become increasingly the case. Doesn't make a university degree not worth it
yep.
at all, and in some jobs it's still a prerequisite. But, you know, a number of New Zealand businesses got together earlier last year and explicitly lobbied the government to say that we want to have introduced micro-credentialing, we want to have more on-the-job training, we want to end this thing that you go away, get educated, and then come and join our workforce.
Mm-hmm.
We want the two to become more integrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a strong expression from industry. The education system is reacting reasonably positively to that.
Yeah.
I want to say, you know, that the young people who... People are often critical of our education system,
mm-hmm.
and it obviously does fail. We have people coming out of school who are still illiterate and yes. innumerate, so that is terrible, it's tragic, and we need to do things about that. But for the great majority of people, young people coming out of our schools and universities today, they are very well educated by yep. global standards. They are, I think, a much better generation, a more principled, a more broader, have a broader aspect on life. Than certainly my generation did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get a bit exasperated with employers who say, oh, you know, the schools are not producing the skills that we need. Well, actually, that's not really the job of the job of the school is not to produce some box that fits into your current assembly line
yeah.
And you can use it for a while, then throw away.
Mm-hmm.
The school's job is to educate people for life, and that includes working skills. But then the firm has a strong responsibility to continue to educate and train and develop and realise the potential of those young people. It needs to be seen in a more dynamic way than I think, oh, the schools are not producing the right people. I think they're producing great young people.
Absolutely. You also mentioned quite recently that you would like to see more young people sitting at board level. How do you think that works on a practical level?
I have said that, and I've continued to think and work around it. My current thinking is that the board environment itself is not well suited to the kind of contributions that young people, I'm talking, say, people in their 20s here,
mm-hmm.
can make. I'm assuming that younger than that, you're engaged in education or in some other thing, and after that, you're sort of in a career or a job of some sort. So what can people in their 20s I think the idea that in any significant number they hold board roles is probably a bit unrealistic the more I've reflected on it.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to find on boards ways to access the thinking of those people. So I think there is a future directors program that is run by the Institute of Directors which can bring young people into the board environment for periods of a year or so, and they can fully participate and fully contribute, and I've seen some good results from that. I think every business needs to look at ways in which it could set up advisory boards or advisory processes for people who are of that younger generation or generations to contribute either in advice to the board or advice to management, and that may be people within the business or people quite outside the business. We need to be more inventive at drawing in those kind of aspirations into the way that we run our business. And a third area which I'm quite intrigued by, I know some firms run reverse mentoring systems where people in a senior position actually enter into a formal, semi-formal relationship with a young person, and the purpose of that is not to train the young person, but for the young person to be the person you bounce things off. And, you know, we're thinking about this at the board. How would that work? You know, and they'll say, you know, dude, you're wrong, or something. That's probably pretty old, pretty old language too. But the way I'm dealing with that is, I go out of my way to, and I find LinkedIn very useful for this because I comment on that quite frequently. And I get quite a large number of young people at very early stages of their careers or students asking to meet with me to chat about something I've said. And I try to do as much of that as I can because I find I'm learning an enormous amount about how they see the business world and how they see the issues that I'm talking about. So even just setting aside time, and I probably spend, you know, a few hours a week involved in those sorts of discussions, which I find very valuable, and which frankly I wouldn't get if instead of doing that I went and sat at the, you know, not picking on the Northern Club, but if I went and sat in the Northern Club dining room and talked to my peers, I wouldn't get that. So I'm better off sitting in a cafe, hopefully not Starbucks, and getting some real input that makes a difference to how I can think. So we can do these things in different ways. I think my comment that I wanted more young people actually on boards was probably a bit unrealistic.
And I suppose, obviously, you're a big advocate for diversity and obviously trying to bring more younger people on the boards. Obviously, you're mentioning maybe that it could be in an advisory capacity, it could be in a mentoring capacity. Why is it that you feel that more sort of senior level people are on boards? Is it purely just because of experience, and is that all that's sort of measured when bringing someone to
board? I still do think I'd like to see younger people coming onto boards. I would like to see, you know, people who are in executive roles in, say, their 30s or 40s taking on a board role as well as their other job. I think it would be good for most careers, most people involved in those situations, and it would be good for the boards. So the historical view of a board has been pretty much that it was a retirement job. Directors hate me saying that, but look around. pretty much someone had finished an executive career, finished a professional career, or was certainly in the last few years of it, and would take on governance as the kind of next thing they did for a period of time. And, you know, for compliance, for a bit of oversight, nothing wrong with that. Experience is important. But for the kind of flexibility and business drive you need today, the fact is, you know, guys my age, we're out of date in many respects. Doesn't mean we're useless, I hope.
Well, absolutely. That's why we're here today.
but you have to have that humility about whether you really are the person who can make the best judgments, provide the best challenges to management about the next step. You know, we, you know, I often comment that, you know, just about every board at the moment has cybersecurity as an issue. But if you look around the board table, most of us are struggling to use our iPhone. our genuine ability to understand or to be knowledgeable or helpful about cybersecurity is just really pretty limited in most cases. Now, that's an extreme example, but I think there are others. You know, we're sitting now not far from Sky City, from the casino. And one of the issues for us is that we do want younger generations to continue to come and play in Sky City, in our casino, have the sort of fun and enjoyment that many people get out of it. But, you know, are those people going to be attracted by the same games that their parents were? Probably not. I think it's a reasonable guess. I think even an old guy could say, you know, probably different things are going to attract those people. What are they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no point in looking at me
about
that. I can have the first insight because it's so blindingly obvious. the others are hard, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and each business has exactly that issue. It's even an issue in, you know, like in Somerset retirement homes. You might think, well, we'd be ideally placed for that. But when you think about people who go into retirement homes, a significant, particularly into aged care,
mm-hmm.
significant decision maker in that is usually the child of the person who is going into care.
Yep.
And so we're talking now about people who are 30 and 40.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do they see their parents? Do they see their parents the same way I do in my 60s?
Yeah.
My parents are gone, as so many of us are at my age. But
yeah.
So we don't really have an insight into how that 30 and 40-year-old cohort is thinking about their parents and about their security in future.
Yeah.
All of those sorts of things. So there's all sorts of reasons for wanting that diversity.
Yeah, it seems like we need as many worldviews as we can get.
Yeah, more is better. Yeah. More is better. Yeah.
You're going to have a different worldview than I'm going to have, and likewise, someone who's 10 years younger than me is going to have something completely different. Yeah.
And if you're going to be all the same culture, all the same age, then, gee, that's a big risk to me because you are the risk that you are missing what is happening and is going to happen is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it might be that you could have, you know, 8 wise white men sitting there. Well, they want to have very good communication channels, and they'd want to have very open minds,
mm-hmm.
or I think the risk is huge. So easy shortcut to that, the typical Kiwi way, let's find a shortcut, is actually let's spread the people.
It's quite interesting. New Zealand has a huge skill shortage, and I suppose the world has a massive skill shortage across nearly every industry. How does a young person go about getting those skills and getting the sort of respect that they need in order to be sort of be warranted to get those positions?
Gee, you see, I've just said it's very hard to put yourself into the shoes of a younger generation, and I think it is.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure I'm well placed to advise on that. What I would say is I think they have to start by thinking about what sort of person do they want to be, what sort of society they want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
They're the really important decisions. I think they'll pretty quickly reach decisions that I need to acquire some skills if they think about that.
Yep.
Very few people would think about that seriously and then say, I want to laze about and do nothing.
Yeah, sure.
So just assume that if you can get that right, you will find the skills, you will find the positions that will suit you, and just don't narrow yourself down too much. But the key thing for all of us is we're not born to do jobs, you know.
That's 100% true.
Jobs are important.
Yep.
They're critically important. It's the way we live and the way we define ourselves, but we're not born to do jobs. So
and that's something I've been maybe struggling with a little bit recently, because work is such a broad term now that for some of the professional services, working in recruitment, you're with a smartphone, really, and that you're conscious, you're nearly working in some respects. So how do you define work, and when do you shut off? And, you know, it can become that obviously your job is a job, but as the world sort of progresses, it's nearly hard to separate yourself from your job. Do you feel any opinion on that?
Yeah, it is, and it's a bit narrowing, isn't it?
Mm.
See, here's what I think in the broad sweep of history. If you think back to the Industrial Revolution, for the Industrial Revolution to work and for jobs as we know them today to emerge, you first had to shake people free from their tie to the land and tie to the land. So that happened most often in violent and unpleasant ways. So partly, as economists would say, supply push and demand pull.
Yep, yep.
But both happened, and it was pretty unpleasant for people while it was happening. But then you ended up with a group of people who could only live by selling their labour. And the jobs, as we know it, really arose out of that.
Yep.
This is what we'll do. I suspect that we're in an era of human history where that is becoming a little bit untenable, because if you go back in New Zealand into the 1950s, for example, wages, base wage rates were set by the arbitration court. And what they did was to look at what wage would be necessary to support a man, his wife and two children at what was then considered an acceptable working class level.
Yep.
Of living. Well, social change and technology change, economic change, has meant that so many of the jobs that are available today, simply there's no way that they will support a person, their spouse, and two children. And the jobs simply won't exist if you force them to do that, and there's no reason to, because the family structure is not there anymore on the other side of it. In many instances, there are either more children or none. You're either one or two, and it changes, and all those things that we're very familiar with. What I think it logically leads to is the tight link that was formed in the Industrial Revolution and maintained since then in various ways, the tight link between the job you did and the living standard you had is going to get smashed. And I think what we're seeing that now. The gig economy, I think, is one kind of representative of that. So you've got people now in the United States and in New Zealand doing three or four jobs and feeling that's the way they make up their living package. So you can't say that job defines you. You're not an Uber driver. You're this, that, and you're all those things. And you've got a living standard coming out of it, which may still be inadequate. And I think this is some of the thinking that's going on around the world behind, you know, a universal wage, you know, that's divorced from the job you do. So the job becomes something you do for a whole bundle of reasons, one of which is income, but it's not the driving force of it. So I think we're going to see that change happening a lot in the next few decades. I think children being born today are not going to see the close connection between the job I do and the income I have. We're going to split those two things.
Do you feel that the way that work is progressing at the moment, that has a correlation to, you know, the workplace depression and higher sort of depression rates throughout the world?
I can't draw the link, but I believe it's highly unlikely that it doesn't, is how I think about it. But this is an exaggeration, but I'm fond of saying that we still run our businesses like 19th century cotton factories to some extent.
Yeah.
We define jobs as terms of, you know, you must be full-time, you must be here on these times, and you must... all those things. We define jobs in quite tight, quite restrictive ways, and yet everything about the rest of our society and about our technologies is saying that's no longer relevant. So I think we've got that tension there. People are caught in the middle of it as they always are. And I think a lot of the mental, emotional and other pain, social pain that we see in the world is partly to do with this disjunction between the way we organise our working lives and what the rest of our world is telling us.
I totally agree with that. Just moving on to something a little bit different. You mentioned in an interview recently that you quoted it as saying you don't know any pessimistic successful business people. What is it about optimism that you feel breeds success?
Well, to me, it's just optimism is life. You wouldn't take the next breath if you weren't optimistic.
Yeah.
And I mean, that sort of trivializes it to some extent, but I still think it's true. It is the breath of life.
Mm-hmm.
And people who, some people who run businesses are just greedy.
Mm-hmm.
And they want a lot for themselves. But most people, in my experience, who own businesses and who run businesses are simply trying to do the right thing for themselves, certainly, their families, certainly, but by and large for their employees and suppliers and customers as well. Because
mm-hmm.
Very hard to run a business of most kinds that's purely grasping and self-centered.
Yeah.
So contrary to that image that maybe concocted a business, businesses of their very nature require the cooperation of so many people
mm-hmm.
that if you don't think positively about the world, if you think everyone's trying to steal off you, you could never sleep, could you? If you ran a business and you thought everyone was nicking things off you the whole time,
you'd have to go far.
Wouldn't work. So yeah. I think at that very simplistic level, when you think about how business actually works rather than the kind of cartoon version of it,
mm-hmm.
Business people are incredibly optimistic people. They are thinking generally the best of people. They're looking for opportunities mm-hmm. for not just themselves, but mm-hmm. for other people.
Yeah.
So it's one of the reasons I like working in business. To many people, it seems odd. The thing I loved working in trade unions. The thing I didn't like about it, and the thing I admire about people who can handle it was so unrelentingly negative.
There were
so many things to deal with that were dealing with the problems that are created in work environments. They are created. It's good that some people are working to deal with them, whether you agree with the way they're doing it or not, it's another thing. But it is, to some extent, unrelentingly negative. You're mm-hmm. dealing with the bad aspects. One of the great things about being in business is, yes, you have to deal with the bad aspects, but you also are dealing with the good things that are happening in cooperation, watching people grow, seeing people develop confidence and abilities and applying them, seeing really happy customers, people who have had a good time, all those sorts of things are tremendous. You know, that's actually quite hard to see when you're in a union official's job. Let me tell you.
Yeah, I can imagine. And is that where you get your fulfillment from, seeing those results rather than just your bottom line increasing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the bottom line mark is important in businesses, and I don't have any issue with that. I think it has to be. I think we probably think too short-term about value, and I think mm-hmm. we possibly don't think broadly enough about sustainable value in many businesses. But as a general concept, a business that's not profitable is not really doing a lot of good for anybody.
Yeah,
means it's not creating any value for itself or for society. So that's one satisfaction. But the biggest satisfaction is the people.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that money is a negative thing, that there can be in society and in some elements of society, being wealthy or being rich is, you know, it is deemed to be quite negative? Do you feel that way, or do you feel that there's a problem with wanting to increase your living standard and your salary bracket?
Look, I don't think intrinsically there is a problem with that. I think it's one of the aspirations of humanity to be better off than they are, to be more comfortable, to have better food, to have better clothing, to have better living standards for themselves, their kids and their whanau. I think one of our problems is that we tend to separate off large chunks of the world, so we can't worry about them, worry about them. But leave that aside. So I think that's important. You know, people often say money's the root of all evil. That's actually not the original quotation.
Mm-hmm.
The original quotation is Radix Malorum Est Cupiditas. It is greed is mm. the root of all evil.
Mm.
And I don't even disagree with that, frankly. Yep. I think greed is about grasping to yourself,
mm-hmm.
whether it's money or something else.
Mm-hmm.
But you can seek improvement in your living standard. You can seek improvement, the recognition that money is in our society, of a lift in your status and your well-being.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can seek that without being greedy.
Yep.
I know some quite poor people who I consider greedy,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I know some quite rich people who I consider very generous.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's the money, personally. I think it's what's in your heart and your spirit and your mind.
That's quite refreshing to hear, you know, because there's probably a portion of my life I felt that wanting to, having those natural urges to increase, you know, the outcome of my productivity, I felt was maybe a negative thing, and that maybe I was doing something wrong. But having that sort of spirit and wanting to give back and wanting to help people, I feel is extremely important, and having that right balance.
Yeah, well, I personally believe that, and it's been my my experience of life. I think we tip over the other way too much. I'm not an advocate of the sort of incentive schemes that we operate at senior executive mm-hmm. level.
Mm-hmm.
I think they are often reflections of greed rather than anything else, and have a number of negative aspects to them.
Yep.
And, you know, some of the absolutely excessive compensation things that go on are very negative for society.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, New Zealand, we're not too bad in that respect relative to the rest of the world. I just don't think we should head any further down that track.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. You mentioned a little bit earlier that you use LinkedIn to you know, speak to some of the younger people. You've also, I've noticed over the last couple of years since being in New Zealand, that you're not afraid to voice your opinion. How do you feel about sort of expressing your opinion when you have such tight relationships and working with such big corporates within New Zealand?
Well, you know, look, I've always been a bit mouthy, probably. So that's the first answer.
Yeah.
The second answer is I'm fortunate, I think, to be in some positions where if I say something, it gets listened to by a number of people. I wouldn't overemphasize it, but it gets a reasonable audience. And therefore, I think if I have something to say, I try to be reasonably careful about what it is that I genuinely mean it. But mm-hmm. if I genuinely mean it, I'm better to say it. It doesn't always make me popular amongst other directors
mm-hmm.
If I express a view. But, you know, again, I'm quite fortunate to be in the position now where, let's say I said something and I wouldn't say if I didn't strongly feel it, but I felt something which the rest of one of my businesses thought was against their interests, against the interests of the business, its stakeholders. Well, frankly, I'd still say it and be happy to leave.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I love that attitude.
It doesn't matter enough
yeah.
to me, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm lucky to be in that position.
Do you feel that attitude has maybe got you into the position that you're in?
Well, it hasn't hurt.
Yeah.
Maybe it's been helpful, I don't know.
Mm. Because in some respects, society favours the ones who stand up and talk and say their opinion, as opposed to those who might be a little bit more afraid to do so, in a lot of respects.
Look, I think there's something to be said for that. The myth is that conforming helps.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reality is that conforming, when you don't really mean it, A, makes you unhappy, and B, probably doesn't impress anyone else either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you're better to try to think carefully.
Yeah.
And speak tolerantly, but when you think and speak, be prepared to speak your mind.
Yep. No, I agree. I love that. You also mentioned before that it's quite intellectually demanding and it's quite time demanding to sit on a number of boards. How do you make that time to consume information?
Well, it's all I do. I don't play golf or do anything else. It's my life. It's what I do. If I have an afternoon off, I'll read or listen to a podcast, which I do sometimes. Watch something that I think is a bit challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I relax. That's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've got all the time in the world.
Do you? Is that a hobby for you, or do you feel like that's work?
No, I don't distinguish hobby and work.
It's all
just
the one.
What I do. Yep. I do what I'm interested in. I'm fantastically lucky in that respect. I do very little that I don't want to do.
Yeah. No, it's awesome to see such gratitude as well, that you have such fulfillment in your work.
Dead lucky.
Yeah, awesome. And I suppose just moving things just a little bit on from that. I'm fascinated about daily routines of the sort of high performers in society. Is there any specific daily routines that you have that allow you to show up every day and at that sort of peak level?
You know, my daily routines were terrible for most of my life. I spent about 50 years drinking excessively.
Yeah.
So the way I coped for a large part of my life was work really hard from early in the morning to late at night and then get stuck into some wine.
Yeah.
That eventually took its toll on my body and mind and wasn't really successful. The last couple of years, I've been lucky to kind of turn off that. You know, who knew it was bad for you, that stuff? why didn't someone say it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm now, and I think I need to be at my age, certainly. You know, I get up early in the morning, exercise pretty much every morning of the week.
Mm-hmm.
I set aside time to read. Mm-hmm. I make sure I have time to read and reflect.
Yep.
This year I'm actually trying to do less reading and more thinking.
Oh, yeah?
I think I've gotten to the point of reading too much and my mind was just getting jumbled.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to reflect a bit more. So I do have meditation time as well. And I really enjoy the work I do. So I don't... When you do that, you don't actually find it as tiring as being bored, you know. You know how time passes slowly when you're, I don't know, waiting at an airport or something?
Yeah, sure.
When you're not doing anything
that
you like, when you're not focused, time passes really slowly and it's quite tiring.
Absolutely. How did you, one thing I'm trying to cut back on is... You know, alcohol consumption. Being an Irishman in New Zealand, it's nearly like you've got to drink, you know.
Yeah, some things are compulsory. That's one.
Yeah, that's it. And one thing that I've noticed is that New Zealand can nearly drink Irishmen on the table. So for play deal. How do you moderate that for you? You know, have you completely abstained from that, or is it something that you just every night again?
Everyone's different. I found I haven't had any alcohol for a year, and I find not having any easier than my wife can have one glass of wine, but I'm not really sure I believe in the concept.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, one ends up two bottles sometimes, you know. I can totally understand. Just finishing off things in a bit more lightheartedly, Rob, is there any sort of book, film, song that you consumed at any point in your life, especially maybe during that coming of age time, that you would recommend to a young person today trying to kick off?
Wow. Well, you know, when I was young, I read a fair bit of Marxist literature.
Yeah.
I don't regret that at all, because I think it gave me a lot of insights that I wouldn't otherwise have got. I do believe it's important to read a reasonable amount of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I think that simply reading non-fiction, it's a bit of an interesting concept anyway. There is one argument that there's no such thing as non-fiction. Everything people write is some way. So I think it is important to read a lot of fiction as well as non-fiction. I'm an introvert, so I like being on my own. I've got to force myself to be out and talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't come naturally to me
mm-hmm.
At all. So if you are in that situation, what I would say is if you're an extrovert, learn to listen more.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an introvert, force yourself to get out mm-hmm. more, force yourself to interact with people more.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the main things I've learned. No particular songs or anything. I still listen to 1960s music.
I'm
stuck there.
Okay. Well, no, I really appreciate you coming along, Robin, and giving some insight to...
Hopefully someone finds something useful out of
it. Yeah, absolutely. Well, if not, I certainly have. So thank you very much. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.